The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Using the actual lives of the current Empress of Japan, Her Imperial Majesty Michiko, and her daughter-in-law, Princess Masako, as his starting point, John Burnham Schwartz's The Commoner is the story of a highly educated, well-informed woman from a relatively modest or common background who finds herself through a rather fateful tennis match, marrying into Japanese royalty and assuming the chrysanthemum throne. There is resonance here with Princess Diana, another relative commoner who went from a rather normal and mundane existence to living amidst the claustrophobic and sometimes oppressive House of Windsor. Schwartz's character, Haruko, finds herself living a life she most likely never could have dreamed of, one not as dreamy as the chrysanthemums of her throne suggested. John Burnham Schwartz provides an inside, albeit fictionalized, account based upon the actual experience of the current Empress of Japan, a highly independent woman confronted with the horror of living her life in accordance with the intensely rigid principles and customs of the Japanese royal family, as enforced in rather draconian fashion by the 1,300-year-old imperial household agency. John Burnham Schwartz is the author of the novels Claire Marvel, Bicycle Days, and Reservation Road, which has been made into a motion picture recently based on his screenplay. His books have been translated into more than 15 languages, and his writing has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Boston Globe, and Vogue. In conversation this evening with John Burnham Schwartz is the nationally recognized Anne Taylor Fleming. She is a regular on-camera essayist for the NewsHour, Jim Lehrer, and the author of two novels, As If Love Were Enough, Marriage, a Duet, and a work of nonfiction, Motherhood Deferred, A Woman's Journey. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, The New Yorker, Town and Country, and more. She has been a TV commentator for CBS and a radio commentator for NBC. This evening's conversation will conclude with a 10 to 15 minute Q&A. Yes, this is a question and answer period, a golden opportunity to ask this evening's author that burning question that you've always wanted to ask, but we just ask and remind you to please make it a question rather than a statement. We will be using a microphone for your question, so please wait for it to get to you before asking that question. If it's worth asking, it's worth hearing. Our program this evening will conclude with a book signing in the Taper Lobby. There are books on sale out there if you haven't noticed already. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in silencing your cell phones and in welcoming two authors with three names each, John Burnham Schwartz and Anne Taylor Fleming.
That would be six names between us.
Hello. Does anyone want to move down a little closer? We're a little... No? You're all happy up there? Okay. I pretend no objectivity when it comes to John Burnham Schwartz. I've known him 15 years? Is that when we first met?
About 12, yeah, 12, maybe somewhere.
And in addition to my deep personal affection for him, I have the most... profound respect for his choices as a writer. John has kept the faith as a novelist, as a serious novelist, which is almost impossible to do in today's world. I don't know how he's making a living at it, and maybe... Are you? Are you? That's my burning question, yeah. Anyway. But he has at each turn not rested on any previous success, but kept pushing out. And this new book is uncommon in the artistic risk that he takes. I mean, John is clearly an attractive white guy who lives in Brooklyn, and he has, for all intents and purposes, channeled at the deepest part a Japanese, cloistered Japanese princess. How does that come? How did that happen?
Not that easily, but I think to go back a little bit, there are a couple of, one aspect is the fact that she's Japanese, and the other aspect is the fact that she's a woman. And about the Japanese part, I'll say I was an East Asian Studies major at Harvard about 20 years ago, and lived in Japan when I was 21. And at that time was, really sort of enraptured by the idea of the culture. I won't even say the culture. I mean, it was really my idea of what the place was. I hadn't been there yet, and I'd already been studying the language for a few years. I had an idea, I think, that it was a place that would embrace me and take me in some way, and that I could fashion myself anew there in a place that I hadn't really been anyway. And I got there, and I lived there for about 5 months, and I lived with a family. I didn't speak any English, and I worked for a company. And, like most young crushes, I mean, it's the reality and the wanting are not the same thing. And I came back, and it became the basis for my thesis at Harvard. I persuaded them to let me write fiction, and I ended up writing a first novel, Bicycle Days. But that's about an American in Japan, a book like many first books that sort of mirrored my own experiences. I fell out of love with Japan. It was a culture that would not have me, no matter what you study or what you do. Yeah. And I lived in Europe, I wrote other books. But around the middle of the 90s, I began to become aware of the story a little bit more. I was always aware of the fact that the Empress was the first commoner ever to marry into the imperial family in 1959 at the age of 24. And the degree, to some degree, how old the family was, and to some degree, how secretive and cloistered the family was, I still didn't really understand. And I will go into that a little bit later on, probably, but exactly how mysterious and cloistered and strange it is. I have a great aunt who's almost 96 now, and she's a legendary publisher of children's books. She ended up publishing in the early 90s two books of translations that the Empress had made of a well-known Japanese poet for children. The Empress loved the books, invited my aunt to have lunch if she were ever in Japan. My aunt ended up being in Japan and went and had lunch, and they had a two-hour lunch together. And my aunt came back from this trip and full of the details of this lunch, in which the Empress spent the only things that she really said about her own self, where she did acknowledge that she had had a breakdown in the early 60s, in which she had lost her voice for almost 7 months. And the rest of the time, she very politely but very passionately and insistently questioned my aunt about her own life, her own existence, a person who had had an entire career, a person who didn't marry until she was 55 and never had children, who was in Britain during World War II, who had lived a completely independent life. And my aunt was really struck by the fact that it seemed almost as if she were asking about a life that might have been hers had things turned out very differently. And at the end of the lunch, the Empress walked her, insisted on walking her to the door, and then kissed her on the cheek. And you could hear the gasps of everybody around. And it was just, the whole experience was very unusual. And it just sort of stayed with me, because 2 years before that, I had followed the marriage of the crown princess, who had been 2 years ahead of me at Harvard, Masako Owada. I never knew her, but I knew of her, and I knew that she had rejected the crown prince three times already. One can only imagine, since he was heir to the throne that derived its lineage back almost 1,600 years through the male line, a supposedly unbroken line, and even if you question the statistics and the feasibility of this, nonetheless, it's accepted as a sort of cultural fact. And she finally had accepted him and married him in 1993, giving up a dynamic career and probably the possibility of being the head of the first foreign female head of the foreign ministry. She spoke five or six languages, and she had grown up all over the world. And she crossed over the moat as 30 years or 34 years earlier the Empress had, and she disappeared. So that's
there was still a, there was a piece about her just today, I think, or yesterday in the LA Times
about her eating a Mexican meal.
Really?
I mean,
but,
yeah,
yeah. Really, yeah.
It was riveting.
But it did speak again to the. But she rivets people because of the disappearance, which is essentially what your book is about.
Well, I think this gets to the idea of, you know, why a woman and
would do it.
I mean, I think the things about the story that really spoke to me, I mean, this, my aunt's lunch and her account were sort of beginning, but I was still, you know, this is 12 years ago, and I was in the middle of writing Reservation Road, and I went on and wrote Claire Marvel, which, you know, incidentally, is a book in which a woman is, though she is not speaking for most of it, is at the heart of it. And initially, she was going to be speaking, and she was going to be much older. So there, it sort of presaged in some way the writing in a female, older voice. Though, you know, I had no idea that she was going to be a Japanese empress. And it's just as well, really. You know, I think the idea for me, the things that really spoke to me about the subject matter, and I have to say, I'm sorry to say, I have no particular interest in the whole royal family thing. I mean, the Princess Di situation, you know, more or less just sort of went around me. I certainly was aware of it. You couldn't help but be. But I just have no particular interest in the Fergie thing and the Charles and Camilla and, you know, it's just not really. So it wasn't that. It was really the idea that when I thought about it, that this woman had had a privileged but normal childhood. She'd had parents. She'd gone to school. She went to Sacred Heart School. She had friends. She had spontaneous moments. She had pets.
A father who loved her?
I think he did love her. I mean, although, of course, as with so many things, we'll never know anything about these people, about what... I mean, I should really add it, and it's really... I have to sort of sometimes say it over and over again to myself as well, because in the age of YouTube, it's almost impossible to comprehend. But this is a family, and this is where, to some degree, they certainly depart from, let's say, the House of Windsor. These people, about these people, there will never be... You will never see any fragments of letters that appear. You will never see any letters. You will never see letters received from one of the more important members of the imperial family that have been received by an outside person, given to the press, or ever published. No unofficial photographs. No little spontaneous drawings, presents made. You will never see anything that speaks of the particular and human that would tell you what they're actually like or what they were thinking. You'll never see any of this that gets out in the world. They are symbols. And the whole structure, in a way, is designed to pin you and flatten you so that the symbolic nature of your existence is the very thing. And the more human that gets let out, the less symbolic you are. And the idea that someone could have a normal childhood and never know that this was going to happen to her, that at the age of 24, having fallen in love with this prince, and he fallen in love with her, and she apparently chose to do so, though not easily. It's a very difficult and complicated situation, obviously. That she would cross over, find that the choice she thought she was making, in fact, led to a situation in which an entire... structure, entire world and edifice became imposed upon her from above, crushing her, flattening her, and that all the life she would ever have from that moment on was the life she brought with her. That her own children, in fact, would not be her own, but she would be repeatedly told that she in fact was the caretaker for them, that they belonged to the nation. So that was one thing, and the other thing had to do with the relationship between these two women, mm-hmm. 30 years apart. And how the older woman must perceive the younger woman. 30 years later, her son falls in love. The empress having recovered, the crown princess then, having recovered from a nervous breakdown and losing her voice. 30 years later, her son falls in love with the most dynamic career woman of his generation. And it begins again. And what would the older woman feel? What would she want? You could imagine that she would want the younger woman to come down into the bottom of the the well where she is, where she's been existing all this time alone, because she'd wanted for her son's sake, because her son has told them finally after being rejected three times that if he can't marry her, he will marry no one, thus ending 1,600 years of the line. It's a bit of pressure, you know, makes the date a little awkward. And you'll want it perhaps for yourself, because for 30 years you've been down there alone. And so, as the rumors would have it, and maybe it was so, you know, she arranges a meeting with the younger woman, and perhaps she attempts to persuade her to come in. Perhaps she offers to protect her. Then the woman comes down with her. The problem is that the older woman is the only person alive who really knows what that means, who really knows what it is to go down there and cross over. And there's all these elements of guilt, mm-hmm. A certain kind of bond. We won't call it friendship, more complex in some ways. And I don't think that it, I don't know that it exists in real life, but it was a relationship that I really wanted to investigate.
As a novelist, you've obviously done a fair amount of research. This is the first of your four novels, I think, in which you've done a prodigious amount of research. How confusing is that for a novelist to do a fair amount of research, and then, in a sense, you have to decide what to leave out as much as what to leave in?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue, in a way, is for me, because I've actually never really been drawn to the sort of popular historical novels, what we generally think of as historical novels. For me, too often in those novels, the research becomes the main character, and the characters are sort of shunted aside to make room for all of these fascinating facts that the author becomes enamored of, and we too may be interested in. But I can't write a novel without having the characters be at the center of it.
Right.
I for whatever reason, it's not right or wrong, it's just I can't really do it. And I don't have an interest in it. And so the big issue for me was getting away from the story that actually was. I did all this research. And
just stop for a minute.
Yeah.
Where did you do it and how did you do it?
I started gathering books. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever was available in English. My ability to read kanji had long fallen by the wayside. And I gathered as many as I could. Generally, I bought them, mm-hmm. used most of them. Some of them were very obscure. I bought them so I could, you know, mark them up.
Mm-hmm.
And I marked them up. I went online and I started gathering anything I could find. And generally, I really like doing research as a novelist. Which partly means that I'm technically not that proficient at doing research, but it also means that you're not really sure what you're following. You're following a feeling. You're looking for signposts mm-hmm. that haven't emerged yet. And I mean, I'd be looking for a description, an eyewitness description of a garden in Tokyo, a certain part of Tokyo in 1947. And the thing that would interest me, aside from what flowers would be there and in what season, it was about the description of the effect of the ash from the great fires of 1945 and 1944 on the garden, trying to get a sense that there was ash and perhaps how much. And from that, you begin to intuit what it might have smelled like.
Mm-hmm.
And and you're really only interested in looking at it from, in this case, from Haruko's point of view. Because she's an old woman now, or not an old woman, she's in her 70s, but she's going back and she's telling this story. And what is it that you remember about certain things? Well, you may remember what flowers, but it's really the smell of the ash that you remember,
mm-hmm.
because the whole city burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're looking for this, and you read an oral history in which there's an account by a baker on a certain street in Tokyo, and it has to do with the black market during the war. And you take what the baker is telling you about their bake shop and what they're baking and the lines outside and the women and the certain dogs that ran through the streets, and you turn around and you put it in the eyes of a girl who happens to grow up to be the crown princess, but she doesn't know that yet. And you start taking that and you take that area and you try and find out what meaning there is in these details. And generally for me, you know, as I go along, I usually end up throwing out about 500 pages a book, I'm sorry to say. I'm putting in more details than I need, and sometimes the wrong ones. I'm just trying to get in. I'm just trying to get in and see it for myself. What I liked about doing the research is that you're grabbing things off the shelf, you know, and you're sort of, there's an atmosphere before you even know it. And it may not be, it's not your own atmosphere yet, and it's not hers, but it's an atmosphere, and it's something you can work with. And it's easier to step into it, and then you can start. It's always the metaphorical meaning of the detail, you know, and I think this is something, it's just what I remember about reading as a child. You know, it's feeling something behind the scrim. You know, there's a detail, but what does it mean? What does it feel like? Some don't feel like much, you know, and they just fade away. And some have a particular resonance. And in the end, you know, it's like you're tuning something. You have to do that. But first you have to see it, you have to feel it, and you know you're in it when you're not seeing it or feeling it for yourself.
Yeah, you're writing it. How did you do all the research first and then start, or as much as possible, and then sit down and start to write, or were you going back and forth?
I did about 3 or 4 months, and then I started writing. And then I wrote for 3 or 4 months, and then I ended up going to Japan to do research. I say research because I used all of my connections, such as they were, and I ended up having lunch in Tokyo one day with the Grand Chamberlain to the Emperor, who happens to be the second or third highest-ranking member of the Imperial Household Agency, which is this 1,100-member bureaucracy, which determines, and I don't say this lightly, I mean basically every word that is spoken by members of the imperial family and every step that is taken. And my journalist friends in Tokyo could not believe that he made himself available to meet me alone for lunch, because they'd been there for years and had never seen him alone. And I'm quite sure that he made himself available. Aside from, I like to think, because a couple of my books had been published there, but that wasn't it. It was because he found out what I was doing. I mean, that was part of the letter that was written on my behalf. And it's never been done. Certainly, I think he would have been the first to say that a Japanese wouldn't do it. I think the fact that I was doing it was something he just wanted to show up and see for himself what it was about. It was an interesting lunch. I only sweated through my suit once. It was very relaxing and nice.
Did he give you anything?
No. In the beginning, we had this whole exchange of sort of my Harvard ties, his ties, how we sort of connected, and then there was a pause. And he said the letter had come from Professor Donald Keene, who's a great scholar. He's a friend of the Emperor and Empress. He said, so, Professor Keene writes that you are writing a novel about the imperial family, but not about the actual imperial family? And then he just stopped speaking, let the ellipsis. And that was obviously my time to jump forward, and I made I made the speech I had been planning on the subway. We got through the lunch, and at the end of it, he said, but he didn't have to do this. He said very nicely that he would be happy to help me in any way he could. And I smiled. I was obviously very pleased. And I sort of laughed. And I said, you know, really what I'd like to know is the color of the carpets in the bedrooms. And, you know, and he smiled. He laughed. He seemed to think that was really lovely. And then he gave no answer at all. So that was pretty much how it went. And then, so that prepared me for my lunch the next day with one of the Empress's best friends. That was through my great aunt. And she was in children's books, actually, her whole life. And we had a four-hour lunch. I got there to find that, in fact, she had shown the letter that I had written her, my letter of introduction about what I was doing, to the Empress already, and that they had discussed me. She had already spoken to the Grand Chamberlain as well. It's a very small circle. And that the Empress and the friend had decided that the friend would meet with me, and, you know, we'd see how it went. So we had this long lunch, and it was very good. I had by that time learned not to ask any questions at all, because nobody who knows anything will ever tell you. Because you do your research, and then you get to the moat. Beyond the moat, only a handful of people know anything about what these people really think
or feel.
Or feel. and they'll never speak. And so, you know, it's, I mean, you can only be interested in the human. I mean, in the end, that's what it is. I mean, it's somewhere in there, there are these people.
So you cross the moat.
You have to.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're interested,
yeah,
you have to. And I, you know, the great Chilean writer, José Donoso, once said that in his mind, you know, a real novelist is not someone who wants to teach, to tell something, but someone who wants to know something. Mm. And I agree with that. That's really what I agree with.
Did you lose faith with this project at any point, or throw up your hands or say, this is another one for the drawer? I mean, or was there a point at which, conversely, you had that moment where you say, I've got it, I'm going to be okay?
My drawer was already
full with the other
actually.
Ones, yeah.
But I could have come on and borrowed your drawer.
I'll ask you. I have some in my drawer, yeah, too.
All right. You know, I never lost faith with it. It was really a very difficult but absolutely fascinating project to work on. I just, oddly enough, you know, the voice was not an impediment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know why. I'm not sure I want to know why. you know, aside from the cross-dressing that was going on in my house. My wife is deeply relieved the book is over. The voice was just, you know, there. And I think one of the things, I had to develop a relationship with reticence,
mm-hmm,
which is maybe the greatest mode of expression in the Japanese culture of any. The things that are not said and where the spaces come. And I loved negotiating with that,
mm-hmm,
trying to decide as her,
mm-hmm,
what must be left in and what must be taken out. The temporal issues, it covers about 70 years, begins in the early 30s. I mean, it goes back, begins with the early 30s when she was born, and all the way up really to the present. And those are very difficult. Each book, I think, technically has one or two challenges that rise above the others that you really wrestle with, and you always remember.
Mm-hmm.
You remember them in a good way if you feel that you gave it a good bout. And for me, I think dealing with those temporal issues, finding making organic choices that seem to stem organically from how the story was and was becoming, as opposed to sort of random impositions of structure, that was really interesting for me. I mean, you can open it up, and I think it's maybe part three, or between two of the parts, 16 years pass.
Mm-hmm.
16 seems pretty random, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, and it, you know, at one level maybe it is, but at the other level there's nothing random about it, and it's a series of investigations that you make. In this case, not really with structure, because it sort of gets left behind. It's with her life.
Mm-hmm.
So there she is. She marries in 59. She gives birth to a boy rather quickly, which is really actually is all they're supposed to do. So she did that, and you think things would be okay, but in fact, you know, she's being sort of abused by her mother-in-law and by all the nobles in the family who look down upon her, because she's a commoner. And she has a breakdown. All right, so she recovers from the breakdown. She has another child, and all these years pass. What is the relationship that she navigates with this time, with her life?
Mm-hmm.
How do you express that passage of time,
mm-hmm,
that coming, I don't even know if it's coming to terms, that existence? Well, I think maybe you have to express it by a space.
Mm-hmm.
How much space? Well, you know, the Crown Princess is coming down the road when the sun grows up. Whose story is it? The initial draft of the book was very long, and I couldn't be certain that it was Haruko's story. So you really have to, I mean, again, you have to, the deeper you get into it, for me, the sign that I'm really into it is that you begin to see everything and perceive everything, even the structural problems, from your character's eyes. Yeah.
When did you know it was Haruko's book?
I always thought it was. I mean, my very first thought was that I might tell it in two first-person stories, first her story and then the other. And I ruled that out quite quickly. I wanted the scope. Right. I wanted the full resonance of the whole life. And I wanted to know her childhood so that we would know what she gave up. And that's why almost half the book is leading up to, you know, through the day of her marriage. Because if you can't feel that, you can't know what it is to give
it
up.
She's lost. How many drafts?
Seven.
Full drafts?
You know, the first three were full drafts with, you know, just massive excavation, heavy machinery, which supposedly you're not supposed to operate under the influence. And then the last four were variations on that.
And how long from the?
This is about 3 years, which for me really is pretty good. Yeah, but I was coming off having spent 2 years on a novel that I never finished, so we'll call it five.
And what happened? That's the one in the drawer.
Yeah.
One of the ones in the drawer.
Yeah, one of the ones in the drawer.
There's a good question. The one in the drawer that doesn't get finished, apropos of this one, it's like the novelist's choice, the material that holds you, that you know you're going to finish. The one in the drawer, it doesn't get finished. What happens as a novelist?
Well, I'll tell you about that novel and the other one that's in the drawer too. And I spent, I mean, between the two of them, that one, the other one, I was in my 20s. It was right after Bicycle Days. And it paved the way.
We should say that Bicycle Days was an enormous, very early success. He was 24, which sets a kind of high bar, and it can be both good and bad.
It took me about 5 years to recover.
To recover from that success.
Yeah. I think that one also, I mean, between the two of them, I spent about 5 years on those books. It's like kind of going to grad school twice, which I didn't go to grad school, so maybe it's all right. Both those books are closer to my story after my first novel, which was close to my story in many ways. It was the first novel, and I was 21 when I started it. But both those books, in some ways, had elements of stories that seemed tied to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I never got a handle on. And I think for whatever reasons, at this point in my life, I finally realized that I am freer to investigate my craft, my art, such as it is, my imagination, when I pursue stories that really, outwardly at least, on the surface, have nothing to do with my own life. I think when I try and write about things that would seem to come from my own experience, I think I have figured them out. Why else would I be writing them? But in fact, I haven't. And I'm doing a certain working through on the page. And there is a kind of perspective, even a wisdom, that eludes me. Hmm. And the painful part is that I don't know it until after. The book that I spent 2 years on most recently, I mean, I was a grown man, I wasn't a kid, and it was very painful, you can imagine. It's an awful lot of work, 6 days a week, more than 2 years. And I can't be sorry about it. It got me to this book. Mm. And I read it recently for the first time in years, and I would say out of 400 pages, there were probably 80 pages that I thought actually were very, very good. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to have my name on them, except that they're kind of all over.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see now really what the book needs. I actually think I could give it what it needs, except I moved past it.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, though, some of the themes in that book are beginning to, you know, emerge at the edges of the book that I've just begun. But I'm not as surprised about that. I sort of had a feeling.
John has also wrote the screenplay for his book, Reservation Road. And I'm just curious, do you identify yourself as a novelist?
Yes. Yes.
You're stuck with that?
Yes. I think I'm very glad I'm writing as, not because we're on the strike. The Writers Guild.
I'm in
the middle of a contract of writing a script for Denzel Washington, a movie. I like doing the work. It's good, but I'm glad that it didn't happen to me in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me now, and I am the animal I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, the script writing is, it's hard to do anything well. You try and do it well, you get engaged. If you do it well, you feel satisfied. And it ends about here for me. and everything else is where the novel writing takes place. And there's nothing I can do about it. Right. It's just how I am.
And what about the nonfiction? Because you've written some very lyrical and very self-revealing pieces in Vogue and other places. Mm-hmm. How do those? You wrote a lovely piece about the long protracted effort mm-hmm. to have a child.
I like writing personal essays. I'm most interested in subjects that I haven't really dealt with before, that it seems to me that there's something there mm-hmm. beyond the biographical, mm-hmm. some elements, something where an event rubs up against where people were in their lives, a certain moment of transition, and you have a feeling that there's something there that can be expressed, and you're just not sure what it is. And the process of writing the essay is trying to bring that out. It's a kind of developing a picture, and you're not sure what the picture you took was. You know where generally the picture was taken, but you don't know exactly what the picture is. And as you work on the essay, the picture comes out.
I think it's also it siphons off some of that personal stuff. In other words, that you do have in you, but then you don't have to address in the novel.
Yes. That is true. This is a relief probably for everybody. There was in Claire Marvel, there was this scene that takes place at the place where my wife and I happened to propose to my wife. It's a dock in Rhode Island, and it's a very important place to me. In whatever way, while I was writing this scene, I happened to take that dock and kind of twist it around and put it in the heart of a very dark scene that just wasn't very romantic or everything. And my wife wasn't that happy about that. she really wasn't. So this was some years ago. And we had this argument that no doubt has taken place in many writers' households about why she wanted me to cut it out and why, in my mind, our doc was our doc. And this had nothing to do with our doc because it was the doc that seemed to be involved, the characters at the time. Anyway, stubborn bastard that I am, I left it in. And so I went through, just imagine, I went through about 6 drafts with Claire Marvel. Let's say that it was on page 82. In every draft, my wife reads all of my work. In every single draft that you will see,
she didn't just mark it.
In the margin of page 82 at this scene, she wrote, I can't even repeat it. It's like just an enormous, the color of the lettering changed. Sometimes she'd have a red pen. Years would pass. This book took, a long time. And in every, through the end, she expressed herself and I kept it in. And that's basically,
And it made it into the novel.
It did. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to my question. That was the
I don't even know what the question was.
It's got to be an answer to something.
Critics, just for a second, uh-huh. because you have had in this book, you can go any of you want to Google, you've had just breathtaking reviews. I mean, they've been wonderful.
Yeah,
And they've caught the subtlety and the nuance, and they've really spoken to it. And that's, it's wonderful. You've also occasionally had reviews that were not as stunning. You've not had really stinker reviews.
Oh, we've had a couple. Those are the ones I remember.
Okay, see, that was the long way around. That's like all good writers, what you remember is the bad things.
Take
any of it in? Does it matter? Does it mean anything?
I have taken it in. It's never meant anything to me in the way of writing.
Right.
What we always are sort of imagining or waiting for is something written by someone and we deeply respect mm-hmm. who's going to write a long, insightful essay about our work. And out in the arena where criticism takes place, this isn't going to happen.
No.
And I think, right now is the first time in 20 years or 18 years that I feel reasonably calm being on tour. I'm traveling a lot for the book, but I just feel part of it is being a father. I have a mm-hmm. boy who just turned 2. Mm-hmm. Part of it is that I was able to get a book started before I left, so I'm thinking about that. But part of it is that, my only interest in the criticism it right now, really, if you get a good one, you say thanks. And you say thanks because it's a practical matter.
Yeah.
You hope it doesn't impede the book. But most of these people are under duress and they have to write 4 reviews a week. You write your work to be read right through, but you also write it to be read carefully. And it's just almost an impossibility given the situation. And so, you kind of like check that one off and say thank you. And you should say thank you because it's a series of, it's a matter of luck and a variety of other things. And then you go on. And I feel that I feel like I know what's in the book. Mm-hmm. I feel like I did all the work I wanted to do to it, and I didn't leave anything on the mm-hmm. table. Mm-hmm. And that feeling to me is more important than anything else. I do want to be read. Yeah. I certainly want to be read by people I respect, and I would like to be read generally. Mm-hmm. And I'm very open to people's interpretation. Mm-hmm. But that's different sometimes than what we call criticism mm-hmm. in the press, which isn't always criticism. It's just a sort of reporting, in a sense, of one experience.
Right. I would like to open it up to questions. And don't we have did we start at 7? So it's like 10 of 8? Because I want everybody to get a chance. I just want to ask you one last question. Do you read when you're writing? Who do you read and who do you love?
The last question is always tough because the mind just goes blank, you know. I do read. I find that if I'm not reading, I'm probably not working that well.
Mm-hmm.
I just went through a period this fall where I was writing a film script. Mm-hmm. I'd handed in a novel. I was traveling for the movie. I was judging a prize in which I was supposed to read 43 novels, and all of these things gave me a feeling of inhabiting a surface life
mm-hmm.
without any interior. Mm-hmm. And it was just driving me completely mad. I wasn't writing fiction. And I literally, and this is what happens, I mean, I had to get back to being the person who could read again.
Mm-hmm.
So I reread War and Peace. There's this new translation. It's fantastic. And I hadn't read it since I was 24. And it was wonderful, but it was just the act of picking up this big book. And taking those steps to get inside of it. And then being inside of it and just carrying it everywhere. And from that moment on, I've been reading again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing the mm-hmm. new book again. And so you have to be very careful what you write. I mean, you know what you read, you know this, when you're writing.
Right.
And I tend to write a lot in the first person. That's sort of what's interesting me now. And you have to be very careful what first person narratives you read. There are certain voices that have certain pitches and are just more insistent in how they get into your head.
Yeah.
And I find that sometimes getting a little bit of somebody else's rhythm, if it's a good one, in is not a bad thing
right.
because as long as you're aware of it,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like just getting you started.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it suits something that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you really have to be aware of it. You have to be very conscious. And, going off and reading things that are boring or that you're not interested in is not really, that doesn't work either.
Yeah. Questions? Anybody?
I read somewhere that Emperor Akihito had an American tutor
as a young boy, rather on the order of Anna Lowens in Siam. Is that true?
That is true. Her name was Elizabeth Vining. She was Elizabeth Vining. She was from Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. She was a Quaker. And she tutored him, I think, from the age of like 4 or 5 to 12. And she wrote 2 memoirs about her experience with the imperial family and with him.
Are her books still available?
Yes. I think I'm not sure they're in print, but you can find them. I bought my copies, online used, and they were actually invaluable to me, partly because, I mean, to find a memoir written in English, good English, from within that world, but as an outsider, someone who feels the need to explain or to describe certain things that a Japanese wouldn't feel the need, and during particular time periods. So in this case, through the late 30s, and into the late 40s, being in Japan, being in some certain of the summer palaces and the winter palaces of the imperial family, observing certain things, getting a general sense of the nature of a man, even if you can't get a sense of, you know, the actual person. And then the second volume takes place when she comes back for the marriage. And actually, it's two trips. And it was really, it was very useful for me in sort of gathering that period from, let's say, the mid-30s to the late 50s, taking a look at post-war Japan, but in a very particular way.
Anyone else?
Same place. What's your actual writing like? Do you write the same? You write every day?
I think I would, but the little guy, you know, is running around. Ideally, I would write 6 days a week, probably, but the weekends are a little chaotic. I write probably from 9 to 12 or 1, and if I can, if I don't have meetings or other things. I'll write again in the afternoon for a couple of hours and, you know, try and get some exercise. And, you know, I never write at night. I think largely because I don't think I could stand going through the day without knowing if I'd gotten anything done. Mm. It would drive me crazy.
Do you shoot for a certain number of words?
I do.
What's the number of words?
It's changed. I tell you, for years it was only 500 because, I do throw out so much and... I do edit as I go, but in the end, 500 is, you know, it's really skimpy. And so I'm kind of in more in the, Graham Greene was the most famous counter of words. I think he was at 700. I'm sort of in the 700, 750 thing, but, you know, I don't have huge days. I'm just, and I begin every morning generally with a printout of whatever I've done recently. I mean, it's sort of chapter or half a chapter, and I don't go to my desk until I've thoroughly marked it up. And
really?
That can take about an hour sometimes. A lot of ramping up,
to
ramping
get there.
Down. Yeah.
You mentioned that when you went to Japan for the first time, you had a lot of illusions about it, and when you... actually lived there, you came to the realization that I can't remember your exact words, but that you wanted to embrace Japan, but it wouldn't embrace you, something like mm-hmm. that. What was difficult about the culture for you?
It's a good question. I mean, there are a few things. It's a very insular and homogeneous society. I mean, I think certainly by Western standards, I mean, I don't really know culture like it. It's not, you know, unheard of in Asia to find societies that have some of those attributes as well. But there's something about the Japanese society that, and I think the presence of the imperial family is not, it's not by coincidence in a way. I mean, people often say, why is this thing still there? I mean, it just, boggles the mind. And I would argue that that Japan's sense of its own indigenousness, that's even a word,
indigenous.
Its own identity as being separate from other Asian countries from whom they borrowed heavily in the early years of their existence, China, India, Korea, for the building of their culture and the structures of their society. The imperial family has, it's a kind of core, it has almost a core mechanism in which this defines Japan as Japan, separate from others. When you go, there are barriers everywhere. It exists within society itself. I mean, the Japanese, more than any culture I know, have names within their own language, within their own society, for naming others as a way of pushing others away or ostracizing others. The young people, there's a word that describes young people spoken by older people as a kind of foreign species. There are several names actually like that. The famous phrase that a mother will say to a young Japanese child who is acting up is, people will laugh at you. There are all these ways. I think that one of the things that I got out of that experience, being there for 5 months then and going back 3 years ago, which I have to say, I mean, I went back alone. I hadn't traveled like that for years. My wife and son stayed home, and it was a very alienating trip. It really wasn't pleasant. It was kind of strange, and including staying in one of those, incredibly modern high towers in Shinjuku, everything gleaming and electric, and it was just very strange. But the greatest gift that that Japan has given me is my sense of alienation of it. Because empathetically, that's the seed for writing about people who, within that culture themselves, can't connect, where the connection, the human element, is taken from them. In fact, their own narrative. And this is a culture that doesn't want you to tell your own narrative. I don't want to make it sound more draconian than it is, except to say that the imperial family is obviously an extreme example of that anywhere in the world. And yet, these are human beings. Mm-hmm. And that the human act that goes on in there with people whose narratives have been robbed from them is mirrored to any number of degrees in any number of other situations that people who are not in the imperial family know, that we recognize. And I felt there are things about that being there made me feel. I'm not in a rush to go back, but I don't. They're not going to publish this book anyway. They don't want to deal with it.
Anybody else? There was somebody over somewhere.
There's somebody over there.
Oh, here. Sorry.
What discoveries are you making about yourself as a writer? Now that you're a father at this stage in your life?
That's a good question. I think that it's interesting. I feel more solid. That's not something that only writers would feel. I think that the part of me that needs to live in my imagination has been in some way freed up by the fact that I know that the rest of me can be filled in a certain way. It doesn't seem entirely either or, Some of this is just getting older. I'm 42 now. There were years in my 30s where I felt I almost had to train myself to be more of a sort of animal about it, to take more, to be more voracious about my work and about where it came from. I don't feel that now. I just feel that there are so many things that I want to investigate and to do my work. But at the same time, going along in tandem with that is a life, just a sort of human life. And I mean, this makes me sound like a total freak, but I find it sort of comforting. I find the idea that the internal work doesn't need to make you blind. I don't want to live without it. I don't think I can live without it happily. That's something it took me a while to accept as well, recognize and accept. It's a privilege, just as fatherhood is a privilege. I mean, it's a privilege that you don't fully recognize and reckon with until you have gone on the journey to get there. And there's a great deal of work involved in both. It's work at a certain point that you find you were born to do. So that's sort of where I am. It's not that it's all wise and smooth. It's just that, I kind of look forward to doing the work. And To me, that's living. You know, that's the stuff I want to do, and I don't want to be taken away from it now, having gotten here.
Anyone else? I just want to ask you a question about the new novel.
Yeah.
Is it an idea that has been kicking around, or is it a new idea?
You know, it wasn't kicking around. I did write this movie, A Reservation Road, but, you know, it's a movie, and the movie, you know, by this time the movie had been shot, and there were these great actors in it, Joaquin Phoenix, Mark Ruffalo, Jennifer Connelly, Mira Sorvino. Mark Ruffalo plays character of Dwight, and Joaquin plays Ethan.
Right.
But I was sitting on a porch last August, and I was very much looking for a way to get back to a world of a sort of male vernacular voice. Mm-hmm. Something, I mean, all of my books are very different, but I've taken this trip now, and I sort of wanted to come back. Mm-hmm. And I started hearing, there's a character in Reservation Road, there are two fathers particularly, they tell their stories. The story revolves around a tragic death of a child. One of the men, Dwight, accidentally runs over a boy. And it's about what happens, what follows that. I started hearing Dwight's voice. Thing is, in Reservation Road, he's 38, but this was an older voice. Thankfully, it wasn't Mark Ruffalo's voice, though he's a very good actor. It was the voice that I had known when I spent almost six years, writing this book. But it came out in 1998, quite a while ago. And I just started hearing it. And I knew that all the different things that I had been looking at about writing, that this was the story that I had been trying to get to. And so it's a novel that picks up 12 years later. It's Dwight's novel. I think there probably will be a third, a sort of trilogy, and that will be Ethan's novel some years after that. Mm-hmm. And it's really looking at the reverberations and the fallout of one terribly tragic event in the lives of two very different American families over two generations. And I'm very excited.
That's great.
Yeah, again, this sort of gets back to that question you asked. I just, you know, it's the first time I've ever started writing something and just knowing that absolutely that was what I was supposed to be doing. So we'll see how it goes. A lot of hard work.
I guess that's, we're at time, are we? Is it? If anybody has, anybody else want to ask any last questions? Yeah? You can say it, I'll say it aloud. Yeah?
So it won't be translated into Japanese?
Well, you know, all I needed really was my foreign literary agent described to me the expression on the face of the Japanese literary agent when she described what the book was about. And, you know, his jaw dropped and he fled the room. You know, I think it's going to have a very vigorous life on Amazon Japan and very controversial life. I was in New York about 5 days ago, and the owner of this bookshop came up to me and said that several Japanese tourists at different times over the week previous, because the book's only been out 2 weeks, had come up to her and in a very quiet voice, like it's basically like buying booze under the table, you know, had said, do you have that book about, you know? And she held up my book, and you know, they nodded.
That's great.
And they all bought copies, like stuffed them in their bags and went away. Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah, without a few, you know. So that thrilled me. I was really happy. You know, I mean, there are a number of issues involving this. There's an ultra-rightist group in Japan that's still very vigorous after all the years, people who think either that the emperor is still a god, as he had been considered before World War II, or that he should be treated like a god. Every few years, some poor newspaper editor is, you know, stabbed or something because he, you know, he allowed improper honorifics for, or improperly honorifics for the emperor. In 1960, this is the only thing I know of this kind in the last couple of hundred years in Japan. There was a short story written by a well-known Japanese writer that was published in a little literary journal. And it was meant to be satirical, I think, but I think maybe he had the wrong audience. In it, it's a sort of dream, and he tells a dream, the narrator does, in which all the members of the imperial family are beheaded. So this fell a little flat. And there was one of these ultra-rightists broke into the house of the publisher a few months later in the middle of the night carrying a sword. And the publisher was out, so he killed the maid and grievously wounded the man's wife. The publisher and the writer went into exile, and the writer never published again. So my wife is a little concerned about this. I, on the other hand, am just desperate enough for sales that I'm thinking, you know, a nice short sword in the chest. I mean, you know, you never know.
Right.
So anyway, that's sort of the background. We'll see. I mean, I think it's going to get to the Empress, I think. A couple of people who know her have said they're going to put it in her hands. I'm going to send a copy now to the friend I had lunch with. The truth is, you know, after most books, you have a feeling about the book, but you don't have a specific image about the book, something that you carry with you that you still want or that it makes you want. This book is different. I know what I want. I would give anything to be the fly on the wall of two private rooms in the Imperial Palace. One is the Empress's, and one is the Crown Princess.
Yeah.
And I would like to just watch them, each alone, read this book, just to see what happens on their faces. They don't have to say anything, even if they hate it. I just want to see what it looks like on their faces as they read about a story. They read a story that attempts to inhabit a narrative that they'll never be able to tell. Mm-hmm. And because it makes me, to my mind, that layering of wanting and not being able to tell a story, and the telling of stories that may or may not be your own, that's the impulse that makes me write and makes people want stories in the first place. There's something in there, in that relationship, that we all know, but you need to see the face, and I'll never get to.
Mm-hmm. We should leave plenty of time for everybody to buy a book. I can just be flat out. You're here to buy books.
Commerce.
These novelists work really hard. You have to support your local. Anyway, it's a wonderful read. And John will be signing books, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk to you.
I will. Thank you very much
right
for
outside.
Coming.
Right outside.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.